Then came the day of unleavened bread, on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. Jesus sent Peter and John, saying, "Go and make preparations for us to eat the Passover." "Where do you want us to prepare for it?" they asked. He replied, "As you enter the city, a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him to the house that he enters and say to the owner of the house, 'The teacher asks, where is the guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples? He'll show you a large room upstairs, all furnished. Make preparations there.' They left and found things just as Jesus had told them. So they prepared the Passover. When the hour came, Jesus and his apostles reclined at the table. And he said to them, 'I have eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. For I tell you, I will not eat it again until it finds fulfillment in the kingdom of God.' After taking the cup, he gave thanks and said, 'Take this and divide it among you. For I tell you, I will not drink again from the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes.' And he took the bread. He gave thanks and broke it and gave it to them, saying, 'This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' In the same way, after supper, he took the cup, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you. But the hand of him who is going to betray me is with mine on the table. The Son of Man will go as it has been decreed, but woe to that man who betrays him.' They began to question among themselves which of them it might be who would do this." And God will bless the reading of his word.
Good morning. It's good to be with you again. It's lovely to be back here in a lovely March morning. I'm going to ask you to do something this morning. Instead of just falling asleep and waking up at the end of the service, I want you to do something. Will you do that? Good. Three of you anyway. I want you to use your imagination, and I want you to go into the TARDIS and go back 2,000 years. And I want you to meet me in Jerusalem, because that's where we are this morning. Go back 2,000 years in your imagination. Who am I? My name's Peter. I have a brother called Andrew. We were both fishermen until we met this man called Jesus Christ. He was a rabbi, a teacher, and we followed him for 3 years. His teaching was just amazing. They called him Jesus of Nazareth because that's where he was brought up, in the village of Nazareth. What can I say about him? Well, it's actually impossible to describe this man. When we met him at first, he seemed to carry an authority like no one else. He taught about God. He taught about our relationship with God, whom he called his Father. His teaching, as I said already, was just magic. It was powerful. Nothing like what we were used to hearing in the synagogues. He had great wisdom, but great authority. But you know, that's not all. My goodness, I need to tell you about the miracles too, because we weren't long following him And we couldn't believe it. Blind people, he would touch them and they would receive their sight. People who couldn't hear got their hearing back. People that couldn't speak were able to speak. A paralyzed man let through the roof by his friends. The Lord healed him and he was able to walk again. Hemorrhaging, he stopped instantly. And at least three times, we were there when we saw him bring people back from the dead. We were gobsmacked, I tell you. And not only that, you know, as fishermen, we were used to the storms and on the Sea of Galilee, but twice over at least, in the middle of a storm, when we were scared for our lives, we were astounded. He just shouted, "Peace, be calm." And the wind just stopped like that, and the waves just became calm. He had power over nature. He claimed to be God's son. He claimed that he could forgive people's sins. My, the religious leaders, the chief priests, they hated that. They hated him because he was so popular too. The crowds started to follow him all over the countryside. But also they hated him because he upset their quiet existence. He loved the ordinary people. He didn't stand for airs and graces. He helped people find a relationship with God. And the leaders just wanted him out of the way. So we, myself, Andrew, and 10 other guys, we followed Jesus around. He called us his disciples. We were immersed in him. We relied on him. We trusted him. And the truth is, we came to love him. And then we found ourselves in the big city of Jerusalem. And it was the time of the Passover. We weren't to know it, but this would be the final week in Christ's life. And each day, Jesus spent the daylight hours in the temple grounds, in the courtyards, teaching and preaching. And the crowds were flocking around him to hear him. Drinking in the words of this powerful rabbi, his popularity was legendary. But you know, on one of these days, he threw all the tradesmen out of the courts of the temple. He said that this was God's house and it was a place for worship and for prayer, not for a place for doing deals and dishonest trading. And he threw the rogue traders out. He was so angry that day. He tipped over their tables and ushered them out of the temple. My goodness, the priests. They were raging at Jesus. How dare he do that in their territory? But each evening he would retreat out of the city and he would go to the Mount of Olives. Now there it was quiet. Away from the crowds, we would spend the night there just outside the city. We would have peace. And Jesus would teach us. He would allow us to relax. And we learned more and more about him and about his Father in heaven. Now, you need to understand, folks. You need to understand that the tensions in the city were high because of Jesus, but not only because of that, because this was the beginning of the seven-day feast of unleavened bread. It was about to start. The first day would be the Passover on the Friday. And when we Jews celebrated the Passover, we were remembering what God did when he took our people who were slaves in Egypt, had been for 400 years, took us out of Egypt miraculously under the leadership of Moses. And the Passover celebrated that. And so this was the feast time. A famous theologian said this, the preparations for the Passover were elaborate. Roads were repaired. Bridges were made safe. Wayside tombs were whitewashed lest the pilgrim would fail to see them and so touch them and become unclean. And for the weeks before, the story of the Passover and its meaning was a subject of teaching in the synagogues. 2 days before the Passover, there was in every house a ceremonial search for leaven. The householder would take a candle and go into every nook and cranny of every room, getting rid of any particle of leaven, and it was thrown out. Every male Jew who was over the age of responsibility and who lived within 15 miles of the city had to go to the Passover each year. If they lived further away, it was the ambition of every Jewish man to attend the Passover at least once in his lifetime. No matter where he lived. And so, vast numbers attended each year. So the city population was enormously increased. Now you'd ask me how many people lived in Jerusalem in my day. Well, probably between about 50 and 60,000 people. But on the Passover, there would be about 180,000 people there. The population would treble. And the Roman soldiers who were in charge, they became fearful lest there would be riots. So the garrisons were brought in from surrounding areas to go into the city. So tensions were high between the Jews and between the Romans and between the religious leaders and Jesus. The Jewish authorities, including the very highest priest, were determined to destroy our Jesus. Their patience was running out with him. He had won many an argument with them, easily countering their rigid, dead teaching. Jesus knew they were after him. He had been warned. People had said, "Don't go into Jerusalem, it's dangerous." But he went, he had to go. That was his purpose. But the religious leaders thought, "How can we get rid of this guy?" But they knew if they arrested him in public, there would be a public outcry. The crowds would be on his side. And so they were stuck, wondering how they would get him alone. Now, we didn't know it at the time, but I do now know. It's as clear as day, actually. Just as God is always looking for men and women to be his followers, to be his instruments of his good plans, so Satan also does the same. He is on the lookout for people to do his will. And each person needs to decide on which side they will fight. One of our fellow disciples, his name was Judas Iscariot, he got friendly with the chief priests. I don't know how that happened, but he did. And he offered at a price to let them know a suitable time when they could arrest Jesus when he was away from the crowds. He schemed with them to betray our master. Would you believe that? He had followed Jesus for over 3 years. And none of the rest of us had an inkling that this was happening in his mind and in his plans. Only Satan could have influenced Judas to do that. But you know, Judas must have allowed Satan into his heart. You know, there is no handle, as someone once said, no handle on the inside of a human being's heart. No handle on the outside, sorry, of a human being's heart. The handle is in the inside. It must be opened from within. And we have a choice to make. We have a choice whether we open our hearts to God or open our hearts to evil and to Satan. Some poet once wrote this: "To every man there openeth a highway and a low, and every man decideth the way his soul shall go." Do you know, I believe that each one of us needs to decide whose agent we will be. Will we be God's or Satan's? There is no third way. Well, Judas opened his heart up to Satan and opened the way for the religious elite in the country to capture Jesus when there was no one else around. He knew that Jesus went to the Mount of Olives in the evenings so they could find him there. And he told the high priests that. And they were over moon that they had the information where they could quietly, away from the crowds, get a hold of Jesus. Can you believe the treachery of this man? Turned his back on the Lord. What a traitor. And he was paid handsomely for his efforts. And all that happened to Jesus after that was caused by this man's awful treachery. But I need to get back to the story. It was the Passover day, and the Passover lambs had to be slaughtered in the temple grounds in an appropriate way. And the preparations for the Passover meal had to be made in people's homes. And Jesus said to me and John, go and get things ready for the Passover for me. And we said, well, where are we going to celebrate the Passover? And he said, go into the city, and as you go into the city, you'll see a man carrying a jar of water on his shoulders. Now, we rolled our eyes at that because men never carry jars of water on their shoulders. That's a woman's job. So we rolled our eyes and we thought, aye, right. Follow that man, he said, and he will lead you to a house. Knock on the door of that house and speak to the owner and say, look, the teacher is asking, where is the guest room that you've got it ready so that I may eat my Passover with my disciples? And he will show you, he said, Jesus. He will show you into a room upstairs, all furnished, it's all ready. And you make the preparations there for when we come. Well, I tell you, me and John, we sauntered down towards the city and we looked at each other and we said, aye, this is just, we're on a hiding to nowhere here. But sure enough, when we went through the city gates, there was this guy carrying a jar of water. And we thought, oh. And we followed him and he went to a house. And we knocked on the door and we asked the guy, and would you believe it, it happened just as he said. The guy knew all about Jesus. The guy knew that he'd been asked to make the room ready upstairs. And, you know, the two of us felt ashamed because as we'd gone on in, we thought, we'll never see this guy. And what if we get the wrong guy with the water, although that's highly unlikely? Or what if he leads us to the wrong house? What if we had so many what ifs? But we should have known better because we'd seen the Lord do amazing things before, many times. So we had all the preparations done by the time Jesus and the rest of the disciples arrived. We had to get the lamb from the temple appropriately sacrificed, and we made sure that all the herbs and spices, the bread and the wine were there, all laid out on the tables. I tell you, it takes a lot of work to get ready for the Passover meal. The bread, it reminds us of the unleavened bread that the Israelites took with them when they left Egypt. They didn't have time to let the leaven rise the bread, so they took unleavened bread with them. It was also easier to carry because it was flat. It also reminds us of the manna that the Lord supplied every morning for 40 years. And then during the meal, there are four cups of blessing and thanksgiving, taken at various times of the meal. And we had all these cups in place and all the herbs and spices. And although I say it myself, John and I really did a pretty good job. I think our wives would have been quite proud of us, really. We lay on cushions around the table. The table was very low. And somehow we knew. Somehow we knew that this was different, that this, instead of being a joyful, happy celebration, was a solemn occasion. Trouble, tension, fear was in the air. And Jesus started to speak as he often did. And he told us this. He says, listen, guys, I have been longing to eat this Passover meal with you. Do you realize I'm going to suffer very soon and suffer terribly? And this will be the last time that we sit down and have a Passover meal together before what it means is actually fulfilled in real life before your eyes. So please eat with me, for this is unbelievably important and special. And so we ate, talked, and listened. The atmosphere was unduly somber. And then the Lord took one of the cups of wine and he gave thanks for it. And he said this, take this, each one of you. And he handed it round. I won't be drinking wine again, he said, until God's kingdom comes. We hadn't a clue what he was meaning. We were confused and unsettled. Then, do you know what he did? He took the hold of the bread and he gave thanks for it and he broke it into pieces and he handed it round. Now, that was normal. But then he said, when you take this bread, you are looking back, he said. You're looking back to Egypt and to the Exodus and to God's supply of bread for you. But today this bread means something totally different, something totally new. This bread is going to remind you in the future of me. I've just broken it. My body is going to be broken. I'm going to die and suffer. And it is given for you. My life will be poured out for you. Wow, what did he mean? And then Jesus, he hadn't finished. He took the last cup after the supper and he said to us, this cup again, you look back and you think about the thanksgiving for all that God did in delivering our people. But this cup of wine represents something new, God's new covenant, his new agreement with you. A covenant that is made possible by my suffering and by my death and by my death and by my blood, as it were, being shed for you. God's purpose is accomplished by me dying. Through my death, he brings a whole new relationship with him. Then the bombshell. One of you here at this table is planning to betray me. Jesus knew about Judas all along. But he said this, but God is in control. The Son of Man, that's me, says Jesus, will die as God has decreed. This is God's purpose. This is a remarkable plan, extraordinary as that sounds. But the betrayer will pay for his sin. And that is certain. My goodness. We were rocked when he said these things. And we looked at each other suspiciously and said, is it you? Is it me? Who is it? We were alarmed beyond measure. And almost immediately, Judas, who'd been sitting quiet in the corner, as it were, silently got up and left the room, going out into the darkness to do his betraying work. We were shocked to the core. Friends, I'm so sorry to have to admit this, but in the middle of all this, in the middle of betrayal and talk of Christ's suffering, there was an argument among the rest of us. How could we be so stupid? Who was the most important in the disciples? That's what we're arguing about. That, can you believe it? You see, at a meal like this with a rabbi, the tables were set out. Usually there were three tables. There'd be one at the back, as it were, the main table, and then two arms going out the side like a U. And the chief, the rabbi, would sit in the center, the place of honor. And on his right, first on his right, would be the most important guest. On his left, immediate left, would be the second most important guest. The second on the right would be the third most important guest. The second on the left would be the fourth, and we go on like that. The further you were away from the rabbi, the least important you would be. That was a tradition. So if you found yourself at the end, you were the least important. That's the way that society did it. And that's why we were arguing, you know. So stupid, isn't it? Some of us didn't like where we were sat. Our name place wasn't where we thought it should be. And Jesus heard all this. Tempers were flaring. We wanted nearer the Master. We thought we were worth more than the person next to us. And Jesus intervened to our shame. He says, listen carefully, guys. In the non-Jewish world, the kings and the rulers reign over their people, and they're often harsh and brutal. They don't care about their people. They're often rich and ruthless, ordering the ordinary people about, treating them like dirt. Don't you be like that. Don't follow that way. My followers are not in a competition, trying to have the most power or be the most important while looking down on others. Now, if you happen to be rich and the world thinks you are important just because you're rich or you have a good job or whatever it is, remember, think of yourself as if you're a little child, someone who has no power, someone who has no strength and no influence in the world. Be completely humble, he says. If you're my servants, that's what I want you to do. And if you're a boss or a ruler over people, serve them, don't dominate them. Care for them. Be prepared to do the humble tasks that no one else will touch. Those who follow me, continued Jesus, need to have a totally different way of life, different values altogether. Look at me. I'm your Lord and Master. I am rightly at the head of the table, but I am actually your servant. My whole life is given up to care for you, to look after you, to gently lead you and guide you into God's presence, to heal the sick, stand up for those who are poor and frail and weak. I am the Lord, yes. But I serve you all the time. Follow my example and be humble, be caring, serve others with your lives. That's why you're here. My goodness, when Jesus said that, we all fell silent, didn't we? We couldn't look at him. Our eyes were down, ashamed of our behavior, of our pride, of our self-centeredness. It was absolutely true. The Master's whole life seemed to be taken up with helping and caring for others from morning till late at night. He was often exhausted with the long days and sleepless nights looking after other people's needs. And then he said something extraordinary again. He says, just as my Father in heaven has given me the prime place in all creation, as Lord, so I am giving to you all important positions in my kingdom. It's as if you all will have the best seat at the table, right next to me, all of you right next to me. Having others serve you the best of food, as it were. What's more, you will have your own thrones, your own place, as those whom I will delegate as judges over the Israelites. Wow, I still don't understand. What did Jesus mean? But it sounded good. He wasn't finished, though. He had so much more to teach us, this Jesus. For we had so many self-centered and wrong attitudes. It was as if he knew his time on earth was limited, was short, and he wanted to pack everything into these last few hours, leaving us a lasting message. And then he turned and he looked straight at me. I said, Simon, just as Satan has entered into Judas to lead him to betrayal, so the same Satan is attacking you. He wants to desperately ensnare all of you 11, and particularly you, Simon, will be attacked by him. But you know, Simon, I've been praying for you. I have been praying for you that your faith would not be overcome, that you, even when you failed, you would be restored. And when you turn back to me, I'm going to give you a very important job. I want you to strengthen my brothers, my children, helping them to stay faithful. That's your task. Well, I didn't like that, did I? I didn't want to accept that I would be tempted to betray Jesus. That was unthinkable in my mind. Something I definitely wouldn't do. I would stick by him through thick and thin. Nothing would stop me. And I said as much. I protested, Lord, even if you're imprisoned, even if you're executed, I'll go to prison with you and I will be executed with you. I'll defend you all the way to death. I was so confident in myself, wasn't I? And Jesus replied gently and he said, Peter, I have to tell you, before the rooster crows in the morning, three times over you will have denied me. Denied that you even know me. Oh, I was indignant inside, but I didn't say any more. And Jesus says, all of you, you trust me. Keep trusting me wholeheartedly. On previous occasions, I sent you out without any means of support. I sent you out on mission, and you had all your needs met. You didn't lack anything that you needed. But now you are facing an entirely new battle. Life will be hard as my followers. You will be hounded. You will be persecuted. Some of you will be executed because you believe in me. You will need supplies, so be prepared. You will need swords to defend yourselves when people try to kill you. The scriptures forecast that I, the Messiah, will be killed alongside criminals. And that's about to happen before your eyes. The scripture prophecies never lie. What they write comes to be. They're fulfilled to the letter. What has been written is about to happen. And you will be witnesses of all of this. This was the plan all along. That's why I left heaven to come to earth. So be prepared. As followers of me, you will be in danger. In this world, you will have trouble, but I have overcome the world. That's my story, folks. That's where we were in Jerusalem that evening. We would never be the same again. So what can you and I in the 21st century learn from this story? Satan's out to get you if you're a follower of Christ. As soon as you start following Christ, he will be after you. His aim is to destroy or defeat every Christian man or woman. You're his target. And you need to be on guard. Christ asks us, secondly, to remember him. Take the bread and the wine. You've got communion this evening. And he says, I want you there. I want you there. Remember me with my people. Come together and meet with me there. Because the wonderful thing about communion is this, you're not just remembering something in the past, you are meeting with a person about whom it's all centered. You meet with Jesus in the communion. As Christ followers, if you claim to be a Christian, you're called to serve others. You're not here for your own sake. You're called to live your lives in service of others, wherever that be. In your neighborhood, in your family, with your friends, in your clubs, in your jobs, wherever it is, in the church. To serve. You're not to come in here and just sit down and say, I wonder what people are going to do for me today. You should be coming in here and saying, Lord, what can I do for the people in here today? What have you got for me to do? Who do you want me to serve? Who do you want me to speak to encourage? Don't come here just to get. Come here to give. And as you give, you will receive. So important. Don't be a spectator. Be in the team. And Christ, and this is wonderful, he prays for you. He prays for you. He is interceding for you in heaven right now. He knows your problems. He knows your difficulties. He sees everything about it. And the radio over, there was a reading from the story of Hagar. The God who sees me. He is the God who sees me. He sees you. He knows. And if you're in your depths for some reason, he's praying for you. And he will take you through. Trust him. He prays for us so that our faith won't fail when we're attacked by Satan. Or when we make mistakes. And my goodness, I can't count the number of mistakes I still make. And sometimes I'm like Peter, so ashamed. But God makes sure my faith does not fail. For Jesus prays for me. And Christ finally is with his followers through all circumstances. I will be with you always, even to the end of the age. That's the most precious promise. Jesus is with you. Tomorrow, the next day, the next day, the next day. On and on. Never not with you. And that makes total difference to our lives, doesn't it? You can face everything, anything with Jesus. And he will hold you fast. That pure dead brilliant, isn't it? He will hold you fast.